Is Iran's highest mountain higher than Mount Everest?
دماوند از اورست بلندتر است؟
نه. اورست از دماوند بلندتر است. اورست بلندترین کوه دنیاست.
And good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of Six Pillars to Persia. Today, we're looking at the film Pearls on the Ocean Floor, and I'm joined by the director, documentary filmmaker Robert Adanto, exuberant filmmaker, doing his third project now in London. And Pearls was your second, is that right?
That's correct. It followed The Rising Tide, which I completed in 2008, and it was filmed in 2006 in China and Beijing.
That's
Shanghai.
A fascinating film. That's looking at China's explosive growth spurt that it's been having through the eyes of avant-garde artists from China. And you went there.
Yes, I did.
Now, you intended to go to Iran to film Pearls on the Ocean Floor, but what happened?
Well, 2009 happened. The election happened. The scandal happened. The demonstrations happened. And of course, journalists and photographers and documentary filmmakers were not going to be allowed in. I knew that I would not have an opportunity to walk around with a camera given everything that was taking place. But luckily, there's something called Facebook and Twitter, and I was able to stay in contact with all the artists I had contacted previously. Mm-hmm. And we worked it out, and I met some of them in San Francisco. Well, actually, one in San Francisco, a couple in London. Others traveled to Leipzig and another to Berlin. So I was able to get half the artists from Iran, the Islamic Republic, and the other half were in the diaspora somewhere.
I think that worked out really well. I mean, although it might not have been what you intended, but with the women narrating their own story about their art and what their concerns were, the fact that they were in a diaspora and that they were not in their country and they had this continuing relationship with their country and it was coming out through their work turned out to be a very interesting insight.
Yes, and that, I agree. And just the fact that there was all the turmoil taking place, the focus of the world was on Iran. I started filming actually on the day that Michael Jackson died, which was about 8 days after the election. Mm. There was a huge exhibition at the Chelsea Art Museum in New York. People were waiting in line surrounding the museum, trying to get in. Most of the people, I have to say, looked like they had never been in an art gallery before, but there was so much, you know, desire to see art from Iran.
Yeah.
And that energy also permeates throughout the film because it took that year to make it. It only took a year to make it, but it gave perspective to the artists. You know, first there was, you know, the craziness, is my family okay? And then things kind of settled down a bit and there was a little more perspective of, you know, what was going to happen. But initially, there was a lot of panic. Mm. Even on my part, I felt like, do I even deserve to be making this film and asking people about their artwork when all of this death? And I was honored, though, to be part of history in a sense. Everyone was interviewed throughout that time. I finished 2 weeks before that anniversary. Okay. So it's kind of it's a unique project in that way. Also, I feel like women have bore the brunt all these years in Iran in two ways, you know, not only having to wear the hijab, but the fact that they've been narrowly defined by Western media when we think of Iran and Iranian women and we only see the black chador.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's particularly pertinent because you're from America, which would be one of the main proponents of this, stereotype that you're talking about. And the fact that Americans as a whole don't tend to be that savvy about the rest of the world. So there's terms of geography and, history and their own, you know. So the fact that you're an American filmmaker making this film about Iran to tell people, I mean, was it mainly aimed at Americans?
Well, definitely for the West.
Yes.
I've made now two films about two great civilizations, China and Iran, that are hardly ever discussed in grammar schools or high schools in America. I don't know what the situation is in Europe, but they remain enigmas to most Westerners, to most Americans. They know nothing of the contributions of the Islamic world. Certainly, the Islamic civilization blossomed under the Abbasids, and that was the golden age. And several of the Iranian artists, I feel, are drawing from the knowledge and pride they have for their people.
Yeah, it's inherent, really. That's, I mean, it comes out in all aspects of life. But it's fascinating that you should be looking at it. How did you get into it? I mean, I know the poem is from a Hafez.
Correct.
The title is from a Hafez poem.
Yes.
So were you into poetry first? Is that how you got into Iranian?
Actually, religion. I started reading about my favorite basketball player, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, when I was in fourth grade. And like Kareem, I was born Catholic and we were both altar boys.
Because you're South American originally.
I'm Mexican-American. Yeah. And my mother bought me a book on the five great world religions, and I was always fascinated by Islam, and I've always read about it. And I actually have taught for 15 years, and I taught a world cultures program. And after 9/11, I felt like it was very important to teach kids about Islam, about the Middle East, about the real countries and how there are several different cultures within that geopolitical setting. It's not just one big mob, the way it's often portrayed.
And there's also pre-Islamic identity.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, aside from the Egyptians, the most interesting for me has to be Persia.
Now, growing up in America, did you find that compared to other countries, perhaps you don't have a knowledge because you were growing there, but did you learn a lot about the world in terms of any subject? I mean, America's such a big country, but we do say over here that the only way, it's a joke, how do Americans learn geography by going to war?
Yeah, that's
so
sad.
That's the perception.
Yeah, you know, and ironically, though, I have to thank my father for instilling in me a love of reading. He always read.
But you're Mexican, really. You're not the sort of standard American.
I'm not. No. And a lot of, although, you know, I had relatives that fought in World War II in Korea. So a lot of the first documentaries that I saw were like World at War and Victory at Sea and things on the Holocaust. So I got into history, and I've always loved history, even though my MFA in graduate school was in drama. I've always come at plays and movies and literature. I feel like I have to know the culture and the history in which it was created, the context.
That's interesting. Now, talking about the sort of documentary and the history of documentary, I felt your film was almost a tribute to documentary film as a genre because, you allowed this free flow of introspection from the artists. And at least in England, documentary was born out of this kind of social consciousness that came from introspection. And in the 1930s, the country turned inward and they started looking at how do fishermen work? How do children play at school and so on, and started looking at their own. And so I felt in a way, because there was no kind of paternal narrative going on during the film, you were allowing this free flow, and the introspection itself was kind of a tribute to documentary film.
It was a tribute, I guess, to the purest sense of the fly on the wall, although I am very engaged as the questioner.
Yes.
I do all the interviews. I do all the background. I feel like I put as much work into doing the interviews and knowing the subject as I do when I act. So I'm very active, and it's not like I just run the camera and magic happens. But it's also my film. I feel a rejection to the Michael Moore. This is one perspective. Everyone who doesn't think like a hardline leftist is an idiot. Mm. I got sick of documentaries like that, or those that, you know, made light of certain subjects.
Yes. I mean, sometimes comedy is the only way to access a very set mind. By laughing, sometimes you shift their conditioning. So I can understand why he's doing that. But this film had a very feminine touch in that you were very, although you may have been driving the interview, you weren't on the camera, you were very much behind the scenes, and there was this narrative woven through all these different women speaking about their artwork.
Yes. And I want to champion a local gallerist, theorist, film scholar. Her name is Rose Issa. She has a gallery here. Mm. Because it was her writing that actually helped me frame the questions that I would ask all of these women. And as you said, I had some women who were born in Iran prior to the 1979 revolution, those that were born after 79 in Iran and outside of Iran. But I kind of used the 79 revolution as a focal point, because Rose Issa said that, you know, there's really like four themes that all Iranian artists and specifically women are focused on. One is, of course, the revolution and its impact on Iran. Two, the Iran-Iraq war and what that meant to them. Three, if the artist was in the diaspora, this looking nostalgically back or trying to go back to the homeland idea via the artwork. And four, the one that I found most interesting and the one that when I read these articles, I said, boom, there's Marjan Satrapi's Persepolis, was the schizophrenic self navigating the Western world, still, you know, somewhat traditional, but also embracing modernity and all of those kind of conflicts and dualities. I just said that's the story. That's why I didn't include men, including eventually Hamid Debashi, even though I did read Iran, A People Interrupted. I love the book. It gave me a lot of insights. In the end, I just wanted women on film. I had started to put it together and I had like 45 minutes and it's all women. I'm like, I don't need a man in this. And I'm glad you feel as a woman that it did have a feminine touch. I wanted that. And I wanted a topic and a title that spoke to women because I felt like they're the champions of Iran's soul, in a sense. They embody that within their household. They own the household. And I have nothing but praise for what they've done for centuries.
I mean, there is obviously this conflict that some women don't want to own the household. That exists, you know, so that's there. But you went to a lot of free women to talk to them about how they felt restricted by the fact they didn't live in their own country or they couldn't return. So it was a kind of that paradox of being free but not being able to do anything. That was interesting too.
Yeah, and several of them return, go back, create art, but still feel like I'm not happy. You know, there's something that was cut off.
Because it's like your extended family, isn't it, your country? And if your country, if your extended family is not happy, how can you be happy?
Right, yeah. Right. And it's really never been explored before. You know, I've seen a lot of Iranian film, but because of the constraints that the filmmakers are put under, they always have to suggest or use metaphor, and they do a brilliant job.
Yeah, luckily we're a poetic country.
Yeah. And, you know, it shows in the work of, like, Shadi Gaderi, and just... She can't state something so overtly, but she can do it very subtly. And that's what's beautiful about her work.
I mean, I loved her photos when I first saw them because it's kind of sexy, isn't it? You know, you've got this girl, she's all made up, she's covered, but she's really liberal. Look, she's carrying a ghetto blaster. Or look, she's on a bike. And, you know, that's not a unique image to her work. It's become a kind of metaphor in a way, the bike. I mean, if you see the wife of a very famous filmmaker, Mukmal Buff, she made a film called The Day I Became a Woman. Did you see that?
I haven't.
It's a sort of triptych about women struggling in some way in Iran. And one of them is a scene just... girls cycling along a beach racing and one of the girls is not permitted by her family to cycle and the father comes along beside her on a horse, then he goes and fetches the other guys and they're trying to persuade her to get off the bike. She's driven and she carries on this bike, and I think in those photos in that Qajar series that you've used for your poster, there is this kind of timeless image of women within the constraints that they live in, embracing some of them, not always seeing them, and that came out in your film too, having an undefinable identity. So they, in some ways, are embracing Islamic symbols and Islamic way of life, and in some ways, they're embracing Western.
Yeah, that was, I guess, if I were to name one discovery, and the most important is that the United States, the West, and I include England, of course, in this, has always tried to define all the other nations of the world in terms of like a political spectrum of right and left. And you can't do that with Iran. It's a unique culture that doesn't fit in that simple box. You know, there are people that are very religious, but they want certain rights. They want a secular democracy. Mm. It's not as if I can't be very, very religious and still respect somebody's right to be Jewish in the country or to be an atheist in the country.
But we don't like Baha'is or Christians.
Right,
so,
I know.
So that is there too.
Well, yeah, there. Yeah. But again, it's a pluralistic society.
I mean, any country you look at is going to start to become a paradox, is going to be dichotomous in millions of ways. So I think just looking at it is something important because it's not looked at enough properly or in the right way.
I agree.
Now, I was interested in one aspect of the film which came out twice that I remember, because I've seen it once so far, but I think when Shirinesha is talking about the veil, the chador, as a symbol of a protest against the West, say, I feel that when men look at me and I leave the house, I become an object in their eyes. So by wearing the veil, I have a voice, but you can't judge me on my appearance. And another one was a clip of a speech that you played by one of the religious leaders. And he is basically talking about the America of human rights. And he's saying to people, this is the America of human rights, but it's the America of Guantanamo, of Abu Ghraib. And in a way, I felt like you were just slipping it in there that there is some hypocrisy in American sentiment towards Iran. Is that intentional?
Of course it is.
No,
of course it is. And I want Americans, when they see it, to say, no wonder they're pissed at us. Yeah, we have a country that, and it's not just under Bush, which is why I get so upset personally. I consider myself pretty liberal. I'm open, but I feel like the American left has lost its way. We've never recognized the genocide of Native Americans, the enslavement of Africans that were brought across, that really built the country.
And the treatment of Mexicans.
Yeah. I mean, my parents...
When is that film coming? I mean, surely that's going to be
I've got to get a bigger budget. No, but I have been thinking of ways to do something about that. But for instance, like my parents, right? Just one generation. Both of my parents grew up in L.A. And my father's parents grew up in L.A. My mother's parents were both born in Mexico. But both of my parents went to high school in L.A. And they moved after getting married to a nearby smaller city where it was mainly white. And they had a rule that on the weekend, Mexicans could swim on Saturday.
Oh, no.
So that they could drain the pool on Sunday to have clean water for the white people
on
Monday.
What decade?
I'm talking about the 50s and 60s still.
Well, listen, I'll share something with you. In London in the 50s and 60s, there were still signs in hotels and B&Bs saying no dogs, no blacks, no Irish. So, I mean,
yeah,
it's all over.
It's sad.
It's disgusting.
It is. Yeah. It is. And yet, it's not surprising. You know, it's just human nature, I think, to collectively say we're this way, we're better, and anyone who's different is shit.
Well, there are some countries that have never invaded other countries, like India, for example. And I'm not saying it's perfect, but I do think that having a pacifism in the way you run your country and the way you see yourself as a country is possible.
Yeah, and certainly...
Egalitarianism, I mean.
Yes, and in the last... I mean, there's always been the idea of American exceptionalism, even under Obama. There's this idea that we're the great light on the hill, and I've often loved that idea because, you know, democracy is the greatest system.
Yes, we should fight for it.
We should. We should take to the streets. We should change laws when they're wrong.
Yes.
Martin Luther King and all the civil rights leaders showed that.
But Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib are recent. So
yeah.
How can you be trusted if you've got this?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, but even before Guantanamo, and even before, I actually just saw a documentary that a friend made that blew me away. It was about a man, and I didn't know this about American history, an African-American man who died at the age of 95. But when he was 5 years old in kindergarten, five of his friends were introduced to a man from the government. Now, this is 1930-something, and they started doing experiments with radiation. So he had a hole in his head. His brain was completely exposed. By the time he was 80, the radiation had eaten the bone and all his hair. Yeah. But he had no bitterness. He got over it, and he believed that God wanted him to live, and he outlived all his peers who underwent the same surgery because he wanted him to share with the world what had happened, his history.
The injustices of his own country.
Right, and, yeah. And you know about experiments that were done on African Americans in our own country throughout. And so, Abu Ghraib and that torture is sickening. It's still occurring. Even, and this is the other thing that upsets me. You know, Obama ran and said he was going to end it. He hasn't. And yes, it's a complicated situation. Where are we going to put the people that have been taken? But some of those people are innocent. Some of them are children. Some of them may well be in terrorist groups. That's true. But to not give them an attorney and give them the rights, we have no reason then to call ourselves that light on the hill.
No.
And
but it's good to push human rights if you can. But just, you know, it's very difficult to deal with a country that really should be governing itself properly and do that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm really impressed by the drive you have for compassion and understanding. Your films tend to have this, you know, very strong passion behind them, which has got this human interest. And human interest stories are fascinating. You know, there's no better truth than the truths at home. So I wondered about this New Orleans film that you were going to make in 2005, or about the 2005 hurricane. How far have you got with that, and what can we expect?
Well, I did several interviews. I was there twice during this summer near the five-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. What drew me to it was that still most Americans think, well, everything's fine there, and sadly it isn't. Things have gotten better in some sense, but there's a lot of injustice.
Do you think the federal state system causes people not to look outside what's happening in their own state? I mean, why would they be so insular?
Well, some of it, I mean, it's another complex situation. Let me explain. New Orleans, the city, was 75% African American. It's why the mayor at one point, the African American mayor, said he was going to build a chocolate city. Right. It was 75% black.
He said that.
Yeah. He was an African-American. He said that. And it's in all the Spike Lee movies about Hurricane Katrina. But most people don't realize that most of them, or a good half, have never returned to New Orleans. They moved on to Houston. Some of them have a better experience living now in other places in the United States. But they're knocking down all the old neighborhoods. They're not trying to recreate the 9th District. They're trying to make...
To rebuild.
Not only to rebuild, but redefine what New Orleans is. Make it another Miami. Make it a place that has casinos. Oh. Make it a place where people come to spend money.
I'm not sure that's great.
No, it isn't. And so the real culture, the culture which several of the artists spoke about, of living on a porch, of knowing your neighbor, a lot of that
veranda culture that they have, it's very musically orientated as well.
Right,
yeah.
And with food. Yeah, and, yeah. You know, several of the African-American artists spoke about, like when I was growing up, my mother didn't need to hire somebody to take care of me because Mrs. Jones down the street knew, and all the kids would go there. So
if you make this film, it's going to be another story of sort of displacement and disconnect from an original culture because of outside forces.
Yes, but it's one of the reasons I've kind of put it on pause. That was the initial thing. I was going to do it, and I went back, and I was actually there on the 5th anniversary. I've got amazing footage. Mm. Some of it's going to be used in a new project that I'm doing called 3D, Darkly Digital and Divine, but I want to actually compare Katrina with something else, not another disaster,
okay. But
another tragedy. And show an interconnection.
You mean not a natural disaster, because every tragedy is a disaster.
That's true, but actually, Katrina was a hurricane.
Right.
Okay.
It's a natural disaster.
Yes, but what happened was man-made, and could have. And that was the thing that most Americans don't understand to this day. They knew that
that it's likely to happen.
Not only that, but that. They were going to breach, meaning the walls were going to break, that they were weak. The Army Corps of Engineers had done all the testing. They knew that if a hurricane of degree five hit, we could have hundreds, thousands of deaths. When Hurricane Katrina actually hit, it was only a 3.
Right.
But the reason there was so much tragedy and death was that the wall broke, and all of that water spilled into the 9th District and other parts of the city. Mm. And it happened in the middle of night. There was no electricity. So a lot of people were woken up with water rising, and they had known from a previous from previous hurricanes to always keep an axe in your attic. So a lot of people were found dead in their attics trying to cut holes to get on top of their houses.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, so it's there's a whole side, and it's in Spike Lee's documentary. It's one of the reasons why, like, I didn't want to try to challenge. I don't have the budget to do a film on that, although there's some great photographers who lived in New Orleans before, during, and after, and that's what interested me. Mm. I just want to wait a while to see what I'm going to connect it to.
Okay.
And I have had some ideas.
Now, with Pearls on the Ocean Floor, it's a very Iranian-orientated film. Do you feel that one day you'll be able to visit Iran and sort of examine further what you've seen?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I'd love to definitely go to Shiraz, Persepolis, all the great cities, Tabriz. I had it all. I kind of had it mapped out. I have a great Persian friend, Sonia Aram, who's actually...
Shout out to Sonia.
Yeah. And her great store in Beverly Hills, Mameg. There you go. There's that... what do you call that? The shout out to Sonia Aram, who actually helped me finance the film from the get-go.
Right. She the mother of one of your students.
One of my former students. Mm. And...
great.
Yeah. So, yeah, I do want... She's always told me about Iran from the time I was teaching her son, and that's over 8 years ago.
Now, did you edit the film? Because there's a lot of sense of, you know, things having been knitted together.
Yeah, I don't do the physical editing, but I sit with
direct
an editor.
Editing. Yeah.
Yes. Another former student of mine who's now 28, David Green, who's actually a very talented director himself, but we've stayed in touch all these years. He was in one of the first years that I taught, and he edits, and we work together, and we order a lot of pizza and get the films done.
How did you choose the parts that you were going to keep? Because obviously there's been a lot more recorded in order to get those gems from the conversations you were having.
I mentioned earlier about those four kind of ideas that connect the art. That was one way. Once the film entered into the discussion about art and politics, I had to set it up. So I start with, you know, Jimmy Carter saying, you know, all Iranian citizens are persona non grata, they must leave the country and all of that, and the UN charter. And I wanted to do that because it was like a big, it reminded me what was going on as we were editing the film. Mm. Obama was talking about, you know, more sanctions against Iran. Here we go again. And that was a sentiment that a lot of the artists said, this country has a revolution every 30 years. We've been having one over and over again.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future, and especially what you're creating. For you, you said the act of creating is humanity at its best. So I wish you all the best with your own creativity. Thank you very much for joining us here
today. Thank you for having me.
And if you're listening and you'd like to know more about Pearls on the Ocean Floor, it has its own website and will be screened at SOAS, the School of Oriental African Studies here at London on March the 7th.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Six Pillars to Persia here on Resonance 104.4 FM.